Hello, I'm Nick Dearden, and this is Counterpower, the podcast for global solidarity. Are we experiencing a new world war? It can certainly seem that way. From the conflicts between Afghanistan and Pakistan, to Israel, the United States and Iran, the Sudans, Ethiopia and Somalia, and Russia and Ukraine, to name but a few, it's hard to escape the conclusion that the world is on fire. The Middle East is in many respects the geographical and political epicentre of these global conflicts. As states and armed groups battle for influence and control, it can be easy to get lost in the horror of these entangled wars. And we can overlook how in each and every one of these troubled contexts, there is an abundance of stories of community, mutual aid, love and compassion. The everyday reminders that we have much more in common than that which divides us. Few of the countries of this region more clearly illustrate this than Syria. Thrown into more than a decade of crisis by the decision of its now fallen dictator Bashar al-Assad to wage a bloody war on his own people, Syrians are now dealing with a new political transition under Ahmed al-Sharaa in a fragmented polity with an Israeli occupation in the south of the country and the fallout of Trump's war on Iran. But amid all of this, Syria is also a site of hope, where social movements have supported the people, often in defiance of armed actors. So there's a lot to talk about in the show today, and I'm delighted to be joined by two brilliant guests with an intimate knowledge of the conflict besetting Syria and the wider region. Mahsan Gharibar is an academic with the conflict team at LSE Ideas, and Elif Sarakhan is a writer and contributing editor at The Amagi. In today's show, they offer their insights into what's happening, the history, as well as trying to help us to find glimmers of hope for a sustainable and truly just peace. Elif, Mahsan, welcome to the show. It's the first time any of us have met each other, so maybe some quick introductions. Elif, tell us about yourself.
Oh, I always hate this question. My name's Elif. I'm from London. My parents are Kurdish. I'm, you know, also Kurdish. And what is my background? I'm a social anthropologist, but also a writer, one of those writers who doesn't write very often. I'm also a contributing editor at The Amagi, which is now a new-ish news outlet focused on the Middle East with a bit more of a focus on Kurdistan. And I have a show with The Amagi called The Amagi Mosaic, where I interview people about various topics and areas of the region.
Brilliant. And people can find you wherever they get their podcasts, I'm guessing.
Well, currently on YouTube, on The Amagi's YouTube, but also if they go on The Amagi's website, they will, I'm sure, be able to somehow find it.
Fantastic. So check that out. Mahsan.
First of all, thank you for having me. It's really great to be here with you, Nick and Elif. I'm Mahsan Gharibar. I'm Syrian from Homs. As you said, I work as a policy researcher with the London School of Economics on the Civicness and Conflict Research Group, focusing mainly on Syria. But I also wear different hats. I have different identities. So, of course, I also do. I'm currently doing my PhD on the Social Policy Department in LSE on Syria as well, on the transformation of Syrian civil society over the past decades, I consider myself a part of the Syrian civil society movement. I represented certain civic groups and civil society actors as a main negotiator in the UN Constitutional Committee for Syria, and I was kind of part of the movement in 2011, the Arab Spring movement in Syria, and I've been living here in the UK since 2019 now. Yeah,
thank you. Well, welcome both. Yeah. Mahsan, let's start with you. And I should say, for listeners' benefit, we're recording this on the 8th of April. the situation in the Middle East is moving so fast, it's very difficult to know where we will be. And yesterday, indeed, some of us feared we could be looking at nuclear war or an absolutely calamitous situation today. That has been staved off. Trump has backed down. But for people coming to this from the outside who are just confused by the amount of war and conflict there is in the region, could you, first of all, just start out by explaining a little bit about what's happening and who the main actors are at this moment?
Okay, so we'll start with the impossible task of summarizing the conflicts in the Middle East. Okay, so let me start by talking about the recent transition in Syria, because I think it's a vivid illustration of how these different conflicts are interconnected in the region. And then I will zoom out to talk briefly about the kind of the regional conflict that we're experiencing right now. So the Israel war in Gaza unraveled the Iran's proxy network in the region, and most critically was, of course, the systematic degrading of Hezbollah in Lebanon, which had been the military backbone keeping Assad in power. So with Hezbollah hollowed out and focused on survival at home, Bashar al-Assad lost its main ally, creating an unprecedented window of opportunity that was capitalized by an Islamist military group called Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS, previously proscribed as a terrorist organization, who capitalized on this and launched a very swift military operation, Rad al-Adwan, the deterrence of aggression, which was able to took major cities like Aleppo, Hama, and Homs in the matter of days, mainly because the Syrian army, the Bashar al-Assad's army, the forcibly conscripted army, was didn't want to fight anymore after 15 years. Was overstretched with absolutely no morale for any fighting. So basically, the army surrendered. That's creating an urgency. A regional agreement happened quickly in Doha, then in Aqaba, in Jordan. And Bashar al-Assad escaped Damascus to Moscow, and Ahmed Sharaa was crowned as an interim president in Syria, thus ending half of a century of a brutal reign of the Assad's family. Now, zooming out of that, of course, what happened in Syria, as I said, is just a main maybe event in a chain of events since the 7th of October. So I think also it's very important to look at the region now not as kind of different conflicts. In my opinion, it's the same war being kind of materialized at different fronts at the same time. So you have, of course, two camps here. You have the Israel and its allies, primarily the US on one side, and what is commonly known as the axis of resistance, which basically Iran and its kind of proxy of armed actors, Hezbollah in Lebanon, previously Bashar al-Assad in Syria, the Houthis in Yemen, al-Hajj al-Shaabi in Iraq, which kind of all form this axis of resistance. The biggest development, of course, over the past 6 weeks was the movement from the strategy of containment toward Iran to a direct military confrontation or military operation against the Iranian regime, with the assassination of the kind of top tier leadership of Iran, Khomeini, and other civilian leaders, as well as military leaders of the Iranian Republican Guards, which basically now we are in this situation when Iran retaliated by trying to increase the conflict, the course of the conflict by attacking the Gulf countries, closing the Strait of Hormuz, one of the most significant kind of waterways for oil and gas and kind of the global energy supplies, which is also leading to this kind of global energy crisis. So all of this are happening, as you said, quickly changing. Today, just today, a truce was brokered by Pakistan for 2 weeks, but it seems we don't know if this agreement will hold or not. Specifically, as we're speaking now, Israel has intensified its military operation against Lebanon, targeting Beirut and South Lebanon. Explosions in Kuwait and Bahrain as well. So we don't know really if this truce will hold or not, and what's gonna happen in a kind of very near future.
And Hormuz is fascinating as a microcosm of what's going on here, right? Because one of the problems for the people in this region is that it is such a strategic location for the whole world. I mean, Britain was originally in there because it was its route to India. And then oil was discovered, which only piled misery on the people of the region. So the strategic role this plays means that the great powers are constantly fighting over and inflaming situations in the region, which I guess is why we all know about. You know, we all know about it, but also why the people of that region have suffered for so many decades now at the hands of imperialist powers. Elif, tell us your reaction to that. What would you like to add? And feel free to disagree as well with any of those causes.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, the identification of what is taking place, I would say. You know, of course, as Mazen also said, you know, despite it, you know, it being almost an impossible task to deliver in a few minutes, I would say, you know, I would say more or less sounds, you know, accurate to me, or the kind of reading that I would have on the situation as well. I think on the cause of origins, I think it's, you know, I think about this often, and I suppose the political tradition that I subscribe to in terms of seeing what might be taking place also in a broad civilizational sense, or the ideological elements of it, means that I do think about the question of, you know, causes and so on very often. And of course, we could sit and talk about, you know, 5,000 years of civilization and all of that, which we can go back in history in terms of really seeing the origins. And obviously, historians and archaeologists have, like, you know, spent like generations and generations trying to figure that out. But I think that particularly with our region of the world, I suppose what is a, you know, more sensible way of thinking about or trying to understand what's taking place is thinking about the different turning points. And so I think inevitably everyone will agree that particularly what took place in the region after World War One, in the collapse of, you know, the empires, particularly of the Ottoman Empire, and the kind of establishment of nation states in the region, was perhaps one of the most significant turning points for the Middle East very broadly. And what we're seeing now, and actually if we look there, you know, the kind of design, let's say, I almost feel like when we say design, it like almost trivializes it. But, you know, the design of the region really was anchored in Syria. So I think it's actually like very, very important that when we're talking about what's taking place in the region, we do anchor it with what's happening in Syria once again, because we can see once again that the redesign, or the attempted or the intended redesign of the region, really also is, you know, is being or attempted to be rubber stamped in what has been taking place in Syria. Now, this doesn't mean that, you know, the fall of Assad wasn't a good thing. You know, Mazen's already spoken about that. Like, we agreed that, you know, both Bashar al-Assad and his father Hafez al-Assad obviously ruled Syria with an iron fist. You know, my people, the Kurdish people, were one of the biggest sufferers of it, where millions of people didn't have citizenship and also were brutally oppressed and suppressed and simply denied their existence through policies like the Arab Belt policy and so on of the 20th century. But I think still, we, you know, two things can be true at the same time, right? Like, that obviously, I think, you know, most of us here are agreed on. I think most people listening will be agreed on. Great. But I think there is such a thing as, you know, the alternative obviously not being better. Now, we perhaps will talk a bit more about, you know, both Ahmed al-Sharaa, but also what he represents, you know, also known to many people as Muhammad al-Jalani. We will probably talk about that in a bit more detail. But I think it's important, as Mazen said, to look at what's taking place in the region really in a holistic way. And I think, like no other region probably in the world, everything that takes place is really, really interconnected. You know, for example, again, I think it's undeniable that, you know, what has taken place in Gaza for 2.5 years really gave ammunition to what we're seeing, both what's happened in Syria, but also what's been taking place in Iran, what's also motivated sometimes some of the positive steps, like, you know, a possible peace process in Turkey between the Turkish state and, you know, the PKK and its leader, Abdullah Öcalan. So really, like, the entire region is connected. And I think, and I hope we can talk a bit more about what this means for people, for society, and so on, because I think what we are really seeing is, obviously, it is quite clear what the kind of, I guess we could broadly call the US-Israel camp intend for the region. Whether, you know, some people may describe it as a Greater Israel project, some people may describe it as a, you know, regional, like, hegemonic project by Israel and, you know, backed by the US. That's one camp. And then the other camp, like, as Mazen said as well, you know, when we talk about the axis of resistance or other camps, like, you know, the Gulf states, I think, you know, don't get spoken about very often, mainly because they're never really involved in what I guess we could call, like, hot wars. They don't really get involved in that, but they really are a very, very active force in what is taking place in the region. Obviously, the Turkish state has its own regional ambitions from, you know, Erdogan's self-declared, like, neo-Ottoman ambitions to also other attempts to control the region or dominance over the region. But I think regardless, whatever kind of vision, let's say we talk about, I would argue that all of these visions really propose or would mean a continued unfreedom for peoples of the region. And I think that's why we also need to look at the alternatives that are being developed, being pushed for, being fought for, being struggled for on the ground as well, whether that's, you know, kind of some of the alternatives developed by some of the Kurdish movements, whether it's some of the struggles of other peoples of the region. This is, I think, where anyone listening needs to look at, because I think it's really unfortunate when we're, obviously, I imagine most people listening to this will be based in Britain, but, you know, when we're in the West more broadly, of course, it's important that most people are primarily mobilized by opposing our own governments, of course. But I think we need to be able to do multiple things at once. That need not be that we, therefore, to oppose, you know, US, UK, or, you know, Western imperialism, that must necessitate support for a regime like the Iranian regime, or, you know, some of these other forces, which, as I said, I would argue that really propose and impose continued unfreedom as well. So I think maybe at some point today we can also speak about some of the alternatives, but I would say this is some of the causes. And also these different visions, I think the aesthetics of it look very different. Obviously, what the US and Israel would want for the region would look quite different from what, say, you know, Iran would want for the region aesthetically. But I think actually ideologically, in terms of the state-centric or nation-state-centric approach, I don't actually think they're that different from each other. And I think this is also probably for some an uncomfortable truth that we probably need to contend with quite soon.
I think this is really important.
nothing is black and white in this situation. And there is a tendency here in the West to look at the situation and say, my enemy's enemy is my friend.
Definitely. Yeah.
And how do we get away from that? Because for me, the goal here should surely be to put the people of the ordinary people of the region center stage.
Yeah.
And yet, if you take Syria as you've said, which in many ways can be regarded as the center of what's happening in the region, there have been so few occasions when those people have been center stage. I mean, we had a moment, maybe you could argue, in the 50s and 1960s where they were. But otherwise, there are the great powers of the region, the Gulf states, Israel, Iran, Turkey, and then behind them, the great powers of the world backing one power or another. And the ordinary people's voice is marginalized, and great violence is done to them at the same time. And there was this moment, it seemed to me, in the Arab revolutions, if you want to call them that, where there was the potential for people to become the center of the story again. And that was destroyed in Syria, that moment. Where do you think that momentum is now?
That's a very difficult question, because looking at that momentum as that political agency is basically what I'm trying to do in my research. But I would say, first of all, just quickly commenting on the causes. Of course, I agree with what Elif said about the kind of what's happening now is not a sudden explosion. It's a culmination of decades of unresolved conflict, starting by kind of the post-Ottoman colonial project and how this region was carved up by the French and the British in kind of borders that don't really take into consideration the ethnic, religious, or tribal realities of the region. But also, of course, more recently, I would say the Arab Spring movement kind of shook the entire region, and of course, new regimes has toppled or nearly toppled and changed. But Syria was kind of the survivor of the Assad's regime for so long. I think it was as you said, that momentum was somehow crushed by the continuous presence and the normalization with the presence and the brutality of Bashar al-Assad. And that was actually also that came within a global context, because I would argue that the local is also global. And what happened in Syria was also part of the global stage, the collapse of the liberal order. And we can clearly say that in Gaza, which basically put the question about the universality of accountability and human rights questions the universality of these principles and the liberal values many of Western states have been advocating or spreading over the decades. And of course, for Syrians, the ability for Bashar to survive and to be normalized with and the lack of any kind of justice and accountability is within that collapse of the international system of justice and accountability. And however, I always also believe, I know we're going to discuss that in more details, that the moment of the fall of Bashar al-Assad also recreated hope in the region. However, I'm also afraid that kind of fragile moment of hope is now also being crushed under this ongoing conflict. The ability for people to mobilize is crippled. I know that what happened in Iran couldn't be considered within the kind of the Arab movement or the Arab Spring movement, but when I look at the social movement in Iran after the war, I think that movement is now crushed, which I always thought and hoped that the social movement in Iran could reignite the Arab Spring again, However, I think that moment is also now gone with the current war. When you look at the state of civicness and political mobilization in the region, is also damaged by the current conflict dynamics, by the displacement, the destruction of civilian infrastructure, and I think most importantly, and that's something it's currently happening in Syria, and spreading to the wider region, is the acute polarization of identities. Of kind of this intercommunal conflict that's also as a side effect of the current wars and dynamics which really jeopardize any notion of citizenship and equality and the principles of human rights and this a transnational solidarity amongst the Arab states is seriously under attack. So this is a very difficult moment for social movements, for political movements, for democracy movement in the region, and that actually scares me. But as a Syrian, I learned to be always hopeful, in a perpetual state of hopefulness, maybe in a naive way. But no one expected the Arab Spring. And yet it happened. No one expected the fall of Bashar al-Assad, and yet it happened. So maybe another kind of black swan event will happen soon, which will reignite this social and political movements, hopefully reigniting the Arab Spring moment, that moment that we had in 2011. I believe that moment's still there. The momentum is still there, but it's buried underneath the rubbles, and anger and displacement and poverty. But I would borrow from the Lebanese symbol of a Phoenician bird, which kind of I think symbolizes the ability of our region to be resurrected from fire and from conflict. Mm.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Elif, one more for you before we go to the break. And really, it's about how Israel's genocide in Gaza has transformed what's happening in the region. For many, many years now, I think those of us on the left have looked to the Kurdish struggle as one of the bright spots in the Middle East. That has changed radically as a result of what's happening now. And so I'm wondering if you could maybe say a little bit about how you feel that moment. October 7th, and then the invasion and brutal attacks and war crimes in Gaza have transformed the region and the ability of groups to continue the kind of struggle that we've seen for many years now around Rojava.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very, very important area to discuss. And I would just say, actually, you know, I guess to start answering that, the one part that I would say I slightly disagree with, Mezen, is that I wouldn't say that some of the basic, you were saying like the sectarianism is a side effect of what we're seeing, right? I would actually say, and maybe you would also agree, is actually I think that sectarianism or that polarization of identities and so on is one of the roots of what we're seeing. I don't actually think it's a side effect, because I think there is, you know, there is there is a perspective that we can see that actually, of course, when communities and peoples and movements and so on are either divided or, you know, see each other as like either competition or rivals, of course, that works very well for the in the benefit of the powers that be, right? And we could speak about, you know, what those powers are, but, you know, there's many different layers to it, especially when it comes to the region. I would say, inevitably, obviously, October 7th, you know, the genocide in Gaza, of course, has completely transformed both the region, but also the what the ways in which, you know, liberation struggles, social movements may go about achieving those their aims, right? And in the case of the Kurdish movement, this is why when, for example, Abdullah Öcalan made his call, so in February 2025, essentially to say that the PKK must dissolve itself, lay down arms, and there must be a peace process, he referred to the risk of the Gazaification of other parts of the region. Now, the way I read that was that's not a trivialization of what took place in Gaza. That's in fact to say, if it happened in Gaza, you know, it can happen anywhere else. And I think this is, again, where sometimes it's a bit of an uncomfortable truth for people. Israel is not a never seen before evil in the region. It very much is and takes from other oppressive, genocidal states, you know, leaders and times in history as well. You know, 1.5 million Armenians were killed, you know, 100 years ago, or, you know, just over 100 years ago. And that was very much one of the main, I guess, beginnings of the turning points of the region, you know, in line with the First World War. So I think it makes sense, and I don't think it's a stretch to see the genocide in Gaza as another Armenian genocide in terms of the changes that are intended to be realized in the region. And I think, you know, I have great respect in that sense, therefore, for Abdullah Öcalan for being able to read that in its really broad historical sense. And of course, understanding that that is a, you know, I mean, a grave injustice, like, doesn't even begin to cover it against the Palestinian people, but actually seeing it as really as ammunition for what is intended for the whole region. And the effects on the Kurdish movement has been, you know, on one end, you know, the movement thinking about how it can shift its methods in trying to, you know, let's say broadly, like, achieve liberation. And in the case of, like, the Kurdish freedom movement, that's been through democratic confederalism, which, for those who don't know, is a idea or, you know, anchored in the principles of, you know, local led democracy, gender liberation, and ecology, which for many, I think the reason why Rojava was very, you know, a really big deal, particularly in the West, is that was it was just, it seemed very you know, it broke the script that was incompatible with our region. And of course, in terms of the implementations of it, we can discuss, like, whether where there are critiques to have and where certain things could have been done better and can maybe still be done better. But in terms of the vision for it, that is, I think, what really moved people, is that, wait, hold on a minute. We've been told that the people of the regions either have a choice between, you know, so-called semi-secular dictatorships or Islamist fundamentalism, and this broke the script. And I think that, in that sense, that, you know, that's how it, like, captured the imaginary of many people outside of the Middle East, but actually primarily in the region as well. And I think that's also why I would say that, particularly in the last, you know, I guess, like, over a decade, this is why that movement was also, again, what I argue is, able to revive a revolutionary internationalism that was dormant for quite some time in the region. You know, we saw particularly the PLO-led camps in Lebanon being, like, home to a revolutionary internationalism in the, you know, between the 60s and the 80s, and that had become dormant for quite some decades. And it seemed that was revived, you know, in around, like, 2000 and 12, 13, 14, 15. And I think what has changed for the movement around these ideas, and broadly speaking, the Kurdish people, both in Syria, in parts of Turkey, in Iraq and Iran as well, you know, the Kurdish people are divided into four nation states. And as Mezen said, in a way that, like, obviously those borders have not reflected the fabric of the region. You know, in the case of Kurdistan, you know, literally entire, like, villages were just like driven through and said, okay, this is a border. So villages were divided into two and then suddenly became different countries 100 years ago. So I think what that's changed for the Kurdish people is trying to navigate what seems to be a really an attempt to redesign the region. I think I of course understand that the fall of Assad was really a moment of hope. I also, speaking to many Syrian Arab friends, you know, we can talk about the minorities, and I think it's a bit easier to identify what the position of minorities in Syria are, but Syrian Arab friends who really also see that hope has dwindled already, right? And I think, you know, and I think the Kurdish people in Syria find themselves having to navigate this this imposed new order, which immediately imposed a complete collapse of the autonomy that the administration had built in the north of Syria. And also it came with this hyper-centralist vision for Syria, which clearly even with Assad's and his father's kind of iron fist, clearly didn't work for the country. And now it's like essentially a similar approach to governance with a slightly different flavor. This is, I think, how most people are experiencing that. And I think, you know, I think it's important when we talk about here is the grievances in Syria are not just grievances of the Kurdish minority, the Druze minority, I don't know, the Alawite minority, but actually grievances of many other, particularly, you know, Arab Sunnis. And I say Arab Sunnis because you would think that they would be, you know, if we had this sectarian approach, you would think that they would feel represented by Sharia, right? And there is really a great worry for the future. And again, many Syrians I've spoken to, like Syrian Arabs, they say, you know, it seems that the first year or so of this interim government, the kind of method was to gain as much external and international legitimacy as possible to basically with the idea that therefore they can do whatever they want internally. And I think we need to see the visit of Ahmed al-Sharia to the UK in that vein as well. You know, it seems from like the Prime Minister's statement, the main thing that was discussed was actually what they called the freedom of navigation, which basically means, I think it was in particularly referring to the Strait of Hormuz, but actually, you know, Sharia promising that he will do whatever he can in his capacity that business goes ahead. And I think it's very important that we see what the vision for Syria is, even with that very short Prime Minister's statement on the meeting that, you know, Keir Starmer and Ahmed al-Sharia had. I think that represents everything that is happening, actually.
Let's take a break there. When we come back, we will focus on what's happening in Syria after the fall of Bashar al-Assad.
Hi there, I'm Nick Dearden from Global Justice Now, and I've got a small request. Counterpower isn't just about conversation, as great as that is. It's about turning ideas into action and building real community power. That's why we have a simple pledge to you, our audience. On every single episode, we'll leave you with something that you can do, big or small, to catalyse change. Whether it's the latest big ideas or the movements you need to check out, you'll find them on Counterpower. But to do all of this, we need your help to launch the project. We know it's got great promise, but to get it off the ground, we need your support. We're aiming to raise £8,000 to kick off this exciting project. To support our launch, please go to the crowdfunder linked in the show notes. And one more thing. Whatever you do, don't forget to subscribe, like, and follow so that you never miss an episode. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review.
Okay, we're back. I'm here with Elif Amazan. Elif, you raised some really interesting points there, and you said that hope was dwindling in Syria from a point at which many people had a lot of hope that there could be a transition to a very different sort of society. Mazen, I wonder if you could take us from that point, explain a little bit for listeners what has happened and where you can see hope now in the region.
Of course, yeah, sure. I just want to say that based on the last point that was raised by Elif on the issues of grievances, my father always used to say that this region, this cursed region, has been accumulating grievances and weapons for decades. And I think now we're seeing the kind of the yet another episode of the weaponization of these grievances. So going back to Syria and the question of hope, I need to emphasize first, because I will be very critical about the current transitional period in Syria. But in order to do that, I also wanted to remind the listeners of the context, right? Because I think Elif and I emphasize that context matters and history matters. So let me give you some numbers, some figures, in order to give to put you in the context of Syria now, how the Assad left Syria. Syria has 170,000 missing persons, people who disappeared without a trace, who vanished overnight. Many of them are my friends, family members, colleagues. We don't know where they are. We know that they're dead. They're buried somewhere in a mass grave, but we don't know where. So, and that number is likely to rise to reach 200,000, because now people are encouraged to report their missings. That's the single highest number of forcibly disappeared people since the Second World War. It's way more higher than any other contemporary conflict. Assad regime used chemical weapons between, that's the conservative number, is 86 times, that's the Human Rights Watch number, and 116 times, that's the Syrian Network for Human Rights number. And we can agree that chemical weapons are discriminatory weapons. I would argue they're also weapons of genocide. So this is the Syria emerging now. And of course, the current transition, as I said before, is happening in this critical moment where the liberal order, the liberal values, and the values of human rights, of accountability, of justice, are fading away. We have a U.S. president openly declaring his intention to commit war crimes, and no one is actually pushing back on that. So the transition in Syria is unfolding within that global context, and it's unfolding in the absence of a political agreement. What happened in Syria was a military takeover. It was not due to any sort of a political agreement, any sort of a peace building. Actually, I would also use some of the academic jargon. I would say what's happening now in Syria is a form of liberal peace building, or a kind of authoritarian conflict management, as David Lewis would put it. However, and this is the contradiction in Syria. For all Syrians I know, including myself, the fall of Assad is the happiest moment of our lives, really. But the honeymoon period, as Syrians call it, ended really abruptly and quickly after that. So after the fall of Assad, on the 8th of December, 2024, the armed coalition led by Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, Ahmed Sharaa, launched this victory conference, which is basically a military junta, appointing Ahmed Sharaa as an interim president and pledging allegiance to the most dominant military faction within that very fragile coalition, which is HDS. Then a constitutional declaration was rushed through in March 2025, concentrating power in Sharaa's hands with no sort of accountability measures. Like, for instance, Sharaa has the power to appoint a third of the parliament or the constitutional court members, is also responsible for the security, for the army, for the executive branch. There is no separation of powers. And of course, this happened without any sort of without including any parts of Syrians. So there was no political process or constitutional process that kind of resulted into this constitutional declaration. The Kurds were sidelined. They were not part of any of that process. Most of the civil society groups, I would say all civil society actors, were systematically marginalized and sidelined from that process. So it was a constitutional declaration from one side, and of course that's created a lot of increased a lot of domestic tension with different segments of the Syrian society, including the Kurds, the Druze, the Christians, but also the secular and the civil society and kind of the political movement at large. Then two major sectarian driven massacres happened. One in the in March that happened in the coastal areas. So what started as an attempt by pro-Assad militias, or what Syrians call the Assad's remnants, to take back control over the coastal areas, led to an open military escalations with the newly formed fragile Syrian army, which went out of control. Many armed individuals went into the coastal areas to support the new Syrian army, and extrajudicial killings against Alawites, mainly against civilians, and a lot of kind of sexual violence also happened in that, and the government either couldn't or were not willing to stop most of it. So, and then a couple of months later, in April, another massacre happened in Sueda against the Druze community. Also, what started as a tension or a clash, a small clash between members of the Druze community and some Bedouins, which is kind of the Arab tribes, led into kind of an armed confrontations, which basically led to more than 80,000 armed individuals storming into Sueda and killing hundreds of civilians, and of course committing rape and other sort of sexual violence. And I believe Sueda was sadly a genocidal moment in Syria's recent history, very similar to the genocidal moments of Assad in against the Sunnis in Anhula, in Ghouta, in Homs, and in other areas. And of course, that led to the Druze community feeling kind of disconnected from this new Syria. Many of them, not all of them, but many of them. And both of these massacres degraded any sort of public trust or social trust amongst not all Syrians, but large groups of Syrians. Not only minorities, by the way. But this is also something I would disagree with. That, you know, portraying that Sunnis as a kind of one homogeneous group supporting Ahmad Shah, that's not the case. Sunnis are one of the most complex sects in Syria. Actually, I would argue that they're not actually a sect. You cannot consider them as a sect. They're way more complex than that, and they don't act or react as one sect or one group. There are many groups within what is called the Arab Sunnis in Syria, and of course not all of them have the same kind of amount of support or opposition towards Shah. We cannot categorize Syrians only based on that. So, but these kind of two massacres, the nature of Ahmad Shara and the HDS and their kind of Islamist agenda or Islamist background, enforced this sectarian division in Syria. I'm from Homs, and Homs is the epicenter of sectarianism in Syria because it's the most mixed city, especially between Sunnis, Christians, and Alawites. And the old city of Homs, which is kind of dominantly or permanently Sunnis, were besieged for 4 years by the Syrian army and some of the armed Alawites, which also created a lot of kind of massacres and violations there. So that also created a kind of deep-seated grievances in the city. against the Alawites and the other way around. Now in Homs, there are almost daily incidents of targeting Alawite families or civilians on the streets by some kind of armed individuals on motorcycles. To the north, the increasing tension with the Kurds reached its peak after several consecutive failures to reach any sort of tangible agreement. Mainly because there was no political transitional arrangement in Syria. That didn't exist. There was no political transition process where the kind of the Kurds or the kind of the secular and civil society and, you know, Christians and all of that could participate in. No, it never happened, really. It was kind of a series of forced security arrangements that's the very fragile and they're doomed to fail. However, after kind of this increasing tension and after a lot of kind of push from Turkey, in January 26, with a direct push, as I said, by Turkey, the Syrian army launched an operation against SDF strongholds in Aleppo, which, in my opinion, SDF should have withdrawn from Aleppo a long time ago. So they launched a military operation against the SDF, the Kurdish forces in Aleppo. However, in order to avoid an open confrontation between the newly emerged Syrian army and SDF, the US intervened, and the US envoy to the region, which happens also to be the US ambassador to Turkey, Barak, mainly pushed SDF to agree on a security arrangement with Damascus, stipulating the gradual integration of SDF into the new Syrian army. And of course, the withdrawal of SDF to Al-Hasaka, to a specific and a small region, and the redeployment of the Syrian army over large territories of northeast Syria, which was previously controlled by the Kurdish forces or SDF. What worries me about this very fragile security arrangement, even though that's thus far since January, so over the past couple of months, thankfully, no major violations happened. Of course, there are a lot of tension and issues. But what worries me, it was a forced arrangement where the underlying kind of root causes were not addressed in the arrangement. Basically, they have two major powers, Turkey and the U.S., agreed that this arrangement should happen. And they twisted the arms of their allies in the region, and the agreement happened. But did it actually reflect any genuine reconciliation attempt from both sides, from Damascus and SDF? Absolutely not. Most of the kind of demands, political demands of the Kurdish community hasn't been met. We only have now a presidential decree acknowledging the cultural and linguistic rights of Kurds, which is something, of course, very important, but it's also very symbolic. This is not what the Kurdish movement is all about, and this is not what the Kurdish demands are. The actual political demands of inclusion, of being part of the decision-making, of really kind of being part of the state and having and seriously discussing the issue of decentralization and the kind of the separation of powers, all of that. The Kurds are not part of that. Mm-hmm. And so their political demands and economic demands and haven't really been met or discussed or negotiated in any way. So what we have now is a very fragile security arrangement that's barely holding up. Again, it's currently still kind of in place because the two major powers wanted to be in place, but that's why I don't think it's a sustainable arrangement between Damascus and SDF. So this is where we are now.
So Mazen, thank you. I'll stop you there because I'd like to come over to Elif now, because you've ended there on the situation in the north. Elif, maybe you could explain a little bit. I mean, some of our listeners will be very, very familiar with the Kurdish struggle and Rojava and so on, but maybe you could just, for those who aren't, explain a little bit about where all of that came from. Where this inspirational struggle came from, and feel free to agree or disagree with Mazen's analysis of where things are at this moment, and then I'll come back to you and we'll talk a little bit about hope.
Yeah, I mean, I think I think, you know, again, you know, it's, again, the impossible task of, like, laying out what's been taking place in Syria, particularly, and I think we're agreed on this, as representing or being a microcosm of what is both intended for the rest of the region, but also actually already taking place. And I think the where I would say, you know, where I would say that I have slight issue with is that the, you know, the kind of, I guess, not being sure whether, you know, there was unwillingness or not to, you know, stop some of these massacres. I think, you know, I didn't personally see any statements from or anything from Sharra around what happened in Latakia, so like the Alawite area, the coastal areas, when that happened. But actually when what took place in Sweda against the Druze community, you know, it was quite clear that it was with the tacit blessing of, you know, the interim president in that, you know, he didn't stop it. And he said, and then made some statements saying like, you know, it was kind of malicious, kind of, you know, he wasn't able to control. And but
the,
then
the mobilization of tribes as well. I
yeah,
didn't mention
but
that.
Then, like certain key figures, he also like thanked them.
Yes.
So, you know, it's very clear what's happening there, right? And obviously, you know, particularly in the West, that was just completely ignored. Like that, essentially that blessing that was given. And I think, you know, we need to make no mistake that what happened in the coastal areas and in Sweda in particular would have happened in the North if there wasn't the SDF. We can critique the SDF. That's a whole nother thing. I'm not in the business of, you know, defending till my death like a military force. Although, of course, I can explain, you know, the kind of the formation and so on maybe in a second. But, you know, if it wasn't for that, what we saw in Aleppo, and I think there's a small correction to make here, is that the SDF had already left Aleppo. There was an agreed presence of an Asayish, which is essentially like a local, like military police presence. And sure, they're like, of course, and this wasn't a secret that they have connections to the SDF, but the Aleppo being a very rich, like rich in terms of like a very diverse, also a diverse part of Syria, which actually like basically all parts of Syria, like there's a few areas where there's like certain groups a bit more concentrated, but generally speaking, like a lot of communities also live side by side. And Aleppo is one of them where there's, you know, three majority Kurdish neighborhoods also living, you know, alongside other communities as well. And there was an agreed presence of an Asayish, so like a local police force, that actually, even in the process of that agreement, which I think represents what Sharra and his people also actually, you know, are still proposing to Syria, which is that even in the process of that agreement, the, you know, Sharra's people said that, what his basic, the interim army, let's say, said that they would, that there was an agreement to have certain shared positions, like, you know, kind of checkpoints, I suppose. And because the Asayish and like the SDF and like the Kurdish forces have a lot of women in them as well, they said that they don't want to, in any of the shared positions, they don't want women deployed there. So they would not share checkpoints with women. And actually again, I'm kind of simplifying it for the sake of argument, but like, let's, for the sake of argument, call it the Kurdish side. The Kurdish side agreed in the name of making a agreement when it comes to Aleppo. Now, of course, you know, in like a decentralized, you know, democratic Syria, would you need, you know, what kind of security, you know, setup would exist in different areas, whether it's in Aleppo, whether it's in other parts of the north, whether it's wherever it might be, that of course would be discussed. And as Mazen said, those discussions, whether it would be, whether like it's like a, you know, future Syria conference or anything like that, Sharra has had a year and a half, well, more than that now, yeah, more than that. And there's been none of that. There's been no conference of bringing together different parts of, like, let's say, stakeholders in Syria and so on. That just hasn't existed. It's been, you know, the HCS-led interim government kind of having like either skirmishes, battles, or agreements with different parts and different communities, which again, as Mersin said, is very much in line with the complete concentration of power in the president's position. And, you know, one of the developments that many people in the West, including Tom Barrack, you know, the envoy that also Mersin spoke about, you know, championed was these like presidential decrees that Shara put out around, particularly around the Kurdish people, which was that, you know, like some certain cultural linguistic provisions, but for example, said that like the Kurdish is a national language, but not an official language, for example. And even if he had said it's an official language, it's a presidential decree. A presidential decree is not a constitution. And there's been no efforts to actually start developing a inclusive constitution with every part of Syria. So that's one thing. And even so, like one of the decrees, which is that stateless Kurds in Syria, so those who were deprived of citizenship under both Assad and his father, both Bashar al-Assad and Hafez al-Assad, would get citizenship. But, you know, but even then, when they're filling out the forms, you know, applying for citizenship, which supposedly they would get, there's still not an option to, you know, to select that they're Kurdish. They still have to say that they're Arab on the forms to be able to get a citizenship, because Syria is also still formally the Syrian Arab Republic, which Shara made a point of re-kind of establishing or re-declaring that it would remain a Syrian Arab Republic. So there's those issues with it. And then with the what's been taking place in terms of the you know, the Kurdish movement in the north, and you know, the kind of, I guess, roots of that. And as you said, maybe many people would know about Rojava, and maybe even would have got interested in Syria through Rojava, right? And had a sense of what that might look like. Now, you know, we talk about Ahmed al-Sharr, the interim president, kind of inheriting quite a broken Syria from Assad. Fine, in some ways, I think that's true. But at the same time, he was able to do this with complete international support. But when the people have still from the beginning, of course, some people are critical, but people from the beginning were saying, you know, anyone but Assad, we need to give this man a chance. Where you know, his kind of HTS credentials, his ISIS credentials, his, you know, al-Nusra credentials, his like basically Islamist, quite fundamentalist Islamist jihadi credentials were, you know, we were asked to ignore them and give support to this guy because it's not Assad. But for some reason, when people talk about, you know, the Kurdish forces, or like, let's call it Rojava for the sake of description, it's held to a very different standard. Now, I'm not saying movements and struggles and alternative projects should not be held to high standards. I actually think it should. But I think it's important when we talk about, before I talk a little bit about what actually happened, the context of this, of which this took place, was one, in the context of the fight against the so-called Islamic State, long before the US-led coalition actually took any interest in the Kurdish forces. They were already fighting. And I remember the day that the first coalition plane actually bombed certain ISIS points. And that was at a point where the Kurdish forces had already been fighting for months and months. And actually, it was a very last minute decision, which by the, you know, certain American officials' admission, the Kurds were their last resort in the fight against ISIS. They went to Turkey, they went to other forces, and Turkey outright said that we're not going to fight ISIS. You know, now they're apparently part of the coalition, but they said essentially, they didn't say they're not going to fight ISIS. They were asked to close the border crossing in which ISIS fighters were crossing over to Turkey, getting medical treatment if they were wounded or whatever, and crossing back into Syria. They refused to shut that crossing for ISIS fighters, but then they were able to shut that crossing for refugees, for example. So it was in that context. It was also in the context of constant either from anything from low-level shelling to outright attacks by the Turkish army as well, and also an embargo from the Iraq side, so from the Kurdistan region of Iraq side, and obviously an effective embargo from the south of the north, from, you know, the Assad strongholds. So in that context, there was both a fight against ISIS, both a fight for survival of an entire people in that region, but also an attempt to develop an alternative. Now, we can talk about, I'm sure there's much to talk about, some of the flaws in implementation, some of the flaws in how some of the governance was set up. But, you know, when we talk about hope, so many people that I spoke to in that region said, for example, as a woman, for the first time, I feel like I can walk on the streets in a safe sense, in a safe way. And as a woman, if my husband beats me, for the first time, I feel like there's somewhere I can go. Obviously, there's still, you know, societal kind of pressures and so on that probably prevented many women also still from being able to feel like they can access some of those provisions. But it was really a complete change for particularly women of that region. And I think to understand what's been happening there and, you know, the connection to also some of the movements in the southeast of Turkey, so what Kurds would call North Kurdistan, and also the context in which many people perhaps would have heard about some of the protests in 2022 in Iran through what people called like the Woman Life Freedom movement. That is all connected to a movement that is anchored in principles of what we can call democratic confederalism, which is, as I think said earlier, which is about local democracy, gender liberation and ecology. Now, I find it interesting when we talk about, you know, these kind of ideas, which you would imagine that everyone would want to champion, right? And, you know, and allow for rich discussions of how perhaps that kind of alternative could look like with the the character of like the Druze community in Sweda, or like, you know, other communities in other parts of Syria. There is this very intense sectarianism once again that is being imposed on particularly Syria, but the whole region as a whole. And I think, you know, when we look at the region and when we look at what's been taking place, I personally have many critiques of some of the ways that the implementation of this, what I think is this very promising vision, was realized. But I also understand that as Elif, I'm sitting in London, very comfortable. I don't have a risk to my life on a daily basis. I don't have to think about, you know, my ability to buy bread tomorrow and to be able to heat my home, or, you know, or also to be able to just move around. So I also need to be able to critique things with a humility that also understands some of the impossibilities the movement that was trying to develop this alternative was experiencing. Like I said, you know, the US-led coalition really came in at the last moment to fight against ISIS, right? And I think what people don't understand, and people sometimes, you know, in some ways rightly so, you know, anti-imperialists might critique the US relationship with the SDF and so on. That can be done, but I think in this situation, it's a bit of a different conversation. But people don't understand the nature of that relationship, and actually how the Kurdish-led forces, the SDF, were also continuously trying to balance the really necessary support, military support that they were receiving from the US for the survival of their people, with also their political project. From the very beginning that the US got involved, they have been pressuring the SDF to drop their, I guess we can call like their democratic confederalist ideology. They've been pressuring them. And I remember this, I can't remember his name, but there was this, one of the, one of the US envoys that went to Syria very early on, he said when he went back to Washington, he was in one of the Washington think tanks, and he said this interesting thing where he said, you know, the Kurds are governing in their wake. So recognizing that there is some governance happening in the context of Assad withdrawing his forces from the north. But, you know, they lean a bit too much towards socialism, but basically we're going to figure that out. And so they themselves were very clear from the beginning that the relationship with the Kurdish forces was one against ISIS, but actually they would never agree with the ideology of these forces as well. So I think in the context of critique or trying to understand this part of the region, I think we also need to understand that multi-layered pressure and struggle that the Kurdish-led forces found themselves in, and perhaps how we might be able to, through understanding that, also still continue to support a democratic vision, both for Syria and for the whole region, hopefully.
Elif, thank you. Okay, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll return to the regional and global level, looking at some of the challenges of forging an international vision for peace and justice.
Hello, my name is Elena Ivanova, and I am part of Another Europe is Possible's National Committee. Another Europe is Possible is a democratic movement owned by its members. We know that the political and economic systems we live in are failing people, and so we seek to transform them from below, with solidarity in mind. We fight the global authoritarian turn and the climate crisis by building material links of solidarity with allies, movements and organizations across borders, because we know we are united in fighting these challenges. Another Europe is Possible believes in a real functioning democratic system that gives each one of us a voice. We see the threat from corporate takeover of institutions and the influence of dirty money across our politics. We also see the disillusion that this breeds in people and their turn to far-right populist explanations for the illnesses that plague our society. Our answer is solidarity, real democracy, transforming Europe from below. We believe in free movement for all, and we put forward the political arguments for it. We believe in votes that matter and that count for each one of us. We believe in working with allies across borders to face the challenges together. Another Europe is Possible was founded as a left-wing anti-Brexit campaign during the referendum. And now we are seeing the politics that we warned about rule. We're also seeing the Europe that we still want to have tight links to and a progressive bond with not facing up to the challenges of the day. We see our leaders here in the UK and European leaders across the continent bowing down to Donald Trump, to Netanyahu, to Putin, to the strong men of today. This is not the Europe we want. We want a transformed Europe. A transformed continent in a transformed world, built on solidarity, on justice for all. If you share our vision, then join us. Become a member of Another Europe is Possible. Take part in events, online and in person, in campaigns for migrants' rights, for more democracy, for a real democracy.
Welcome back. Mazen, Elif finished her bit there by describing a little bit about democratic confederalism and what's been happening for a long time in the Kurdish areas. Are there similar or alternatives that are happening elsewhere in Syria? And are there attempts by civil society to reach out beyond the sectarian boundaries so that to begin reformulating what the country as a whole could look like?
Yeah, but let me first start by critiquing the kind of the democratic experience of SDF in Northeast Syria, because I think we also need to put that into context. I would say democracy was never established in Syria, unfortunately. Even so, the SDF has democracy, democratic forces in their name, but that was not the case. Yes, in northeast Syria, there was a way more, maybe relative, way more inclusion of different groups of society, including, of course, women, other minorities, into kind of certain local councils and administrative apparatus here and there. But it was largely controlled by the cadres. The cadres are the PKK kind of main senior officials who basically had all power, and the power was concentrated within their heads. So the democratic experience of Northeast Syria was not always was there. Now, what gives me hope in Syria, in Northeast and in the rest of Syria, is always has been civil society. It's kind of which really matured during a very difficult kind of war situation. And I think the Syrians kind of developed an extraordinary grassroots survival systems. One example, I always give that example. So in Ghouta, in eastern Ghouta, so eastern to Damascus, that was besieged by Bashar al-Assad and his army for 4 years. It was besieged, targeted by chemical weapons, daily aerial bombardments, yet they managed to do to local councils, to elect local councils. They built an entire health system underground. Actually, there is a very important documentary I really wish everyone could see. It's called The Cave. The Cave was the name of the hospital that was actually built underground. And when I visited Ukraine in 2023, I was surprised. I met with Mariupol doctors, and they all know about the Ghouta experience and how they built an entire system. And they were, it was a very kind of pure humanitarian kind of a solidarity moment in Ukraine. Anyways, so a very resilient civil society in Syria has emerged, both inside the country and outside the country. And where the news focuses, and I focused on the massacres and the killings, what's we didn't focus on, and usually it's, you just don't focus on, is the kind of the also the intercommunal solidarity, the hundreds of people who rushed to help each other and to create this kind of different situations, different dynamics. There are many groups now kind of initiated in Syria, talking about social cohesion, peace building, democracy, women rights, human rights, and they're trying to fight back. To find what is now reform, what's now becoming more of an authoritarian transitional era. However, this kind of these spaces of civicness are also highly contested and highly polarized, and gradually kind of restricted by the new authorities. Yet civil society are pushing back. They're trying to reclaim their political agency. Through art, through culture, through dialogue. I always use this image where directly after the fall of Assad, like within the first few weeks, Syrians gathered in this cultural center in rural Damascus to discuss the constitution. Even no one invited them to do so, but they decided, you know what, we can discuss the constitution, we don't need Ahmed Sharaa or any of the transitional government to tell us what to do. They gathered without electricity, they were using their mobile phones to see each other, and they were discussing constitutions, and they were discussing constitutional principles and the ideas of inclusion and rights and economic development and all of that without electricity. This is the resilience of the Syrian people. They're really kind of thirsty to talk politics and to participate. And I don't think anyone could kill that momentum. But Syrians are tired. 90% of the population are below poverty line. And of course, any sort of social movement and political movement, they need time. They need to. Civil society was exiled for a long time. Now civil society is regrouping inside the country, and that would require a lot of time. But also, as I said, there are a lot of challenges by the new authorities, by the uncivil society, basically religious and sectarian leaders who are kind of capitalizing on these perceived or actual grievances for their own political and economic gains, which is something that's now happening all over the country. History tells us that durable peace in war-torn societies almost never comes from elite bargaining, never comes from elite political settlements. It requires a critical mass of people who have built habits of cooperation and solidarity across divides and have something to lose from the return of violence. And I believe Syrians have that. They need time to be able to restitch the country together and rebuild that trust. But no one in Syria wants to go back to violence or kind of just to a spiral of control and all of that. So, and that gives me hope. The hope that Syrians, they don't want most Syrians, ordinary Syrians, Syrians you meet in the street, they don't want the return of violence. They don't want vengeance. They want a decent life, an ability to be able to plan for the future. And I think that gives that gives me hope. And yeah, hopefully one day we Syrians will finally, personally, I'm almost 40 now, never participated in elections in my life. So hopefully one day I will participate in some sort of free and fair elections in Syria.
Thank you very much. Elif, give me your where you derive hope from in this situation. And particularly, it might be interesting for listeners to know what the Kurdish demands are and what the vision is of a new Syria, because it certainly isn't as simple as just saying independence.
Yeah, and actually, it's not independence. Yeah. I mean, I think where I derive hope from is just seeing people's continued, you know, struggle and the continued commitment. And I think many people, particularly who are in the region, really, really understand acutely just how much of a turning point we are living in right now. And whatever happens in these, let's say, few years will really determine the future of our entire region, and which obviously in turn will have impacts on the whole world, right? And so I think, yeah, that's where I derive hope from, is just seeing people continue. And I think the vision is, I think wherever the Kurdish freedom movement is active, the vision is, it seems to be a, you know, decentralized, in this case, you know, when we talk about Syria, but I think the ultimate aim is, you know, these borders that were drawn 100 years ago, by the British and the French, after World War One, I think the idea, the aim would be to deem these borders obsolete, in that, you know, as I said at this earlier on, many villages were just like divided into two countries, more or less overnight, but. Actually, even when I say overnight, there was a period where these borders existed, but like, you know, people, there was still a bit more of a mobility across the region, which I would say actually, especially after the 80s, really became very, very difficult, you know. And that turning point was like the Israel invasion of the south of Lebanon, and what essentially basically brought to an end the kind of, you know, the gathering of different movements and so on in the Bekaa Valley in the south of Lebanon. And I think now when we see, you know, for example, the wall that Trump promised to build in the south of the US, Turkey actually built on its southern border. So there is a, kilometers and kilometers long, I guess I should say miles, we're in Britain, but you know, miles long, huge concrete militarized wall, all across the north of Syria, the south of Turkey, that firstly would need to be dismantled. And this is not to say Turkey can continue to be Turkey, Syria can continue to be Syria, you know, with all of its flaws. In some ways, the European Union, you know, has really worked for many people in terms of the freedom of movement and so on. So what I would say the vision perhaps should be is some sort of, you know, united nations of, you know, West Asia or whatever, where it means that people can actually move across the region, they can work across the region, they can build lives across the region. And, you know, they can actually also, as Mezzi said, like plan, you know, for their lives and so on. So I would say the kind of like Kurdish movement vision is very much in line with what I just said, is about deeming existing borders obsolete rather than drawing new borders, which, you know, some also are pushing for, you know, for Kurdistan as an independent state. And and for there to be in the context of Syria, for there to be a decentralized Syria where certain regions can have autonomy, or if they wish to have autonomy, they can also govern themselves. So I think it, you know, when we say it's almost like we, even when I say I feel like I almost don't believe it myself, because it seems in these moments so far away. But, you know, until it happens, a lot of things feel impossible.
Absolutely. And as frightening as the world feels at the moment, it is probably only in such moments that we get the kind of change that we're talking about. I'd like to leave it there, because I thought your point about the borders was a really good place to. It's a symbol, isn't it, of the way that this region has been carved up. Yeah. By the great powers. I mean, you can literally, for people who haven't looked at a map of the region, I mean, there were just hundreds and hundreds of miles of straight lines sometimes, which have clearly been drawn by civil servants in London, negotiated with the French. And whether it's a period of great power rivalry, whether it's a period of the dominance of one hegemon, the people of this region have suffered enormously. And the idea of putting the people of the region with all of their needs and aspirations at the centre is, I think, the most hopeful thing that we can imagine. And everything that this podcast is about is creating solidarity with those people. And so that's all we've got time for today. I hope you've enjoyed it. Counterpower is produced by Another Europe Is Possible, Global Justice Now, and the Stop Trump Coalition. Our aim is to bring together experts and activists to talk about global justice and inspire you, our audience, into action. If you don't know about our networks and organisations, look us up, get involved, there's a lot to do. And remember, you can help Counterpower keep going by hitting the link in the show notes for our crowdfunder. Don't forget to like, subscribe and follow Counterpower. Maybe even leave us a nice review. We'll see you again soon. We'll be right back.